This is Tea Earl Grey Hot, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. Forget Me Not. Hello and welcome to episode 63 of Tea Earl Grey Hot, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Yannick, I'm the French guy from Switzerland, and joining me tonight is someone who, although isn't joined with a Trill symbiont, definitely appears to be under the influence of something not of this world. It's my good friend Dave. Good evening, Dave.
Good evening, Yannick. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. I'm working from home, getting the least possible social contact. Well, that's what I do anyway, so it doesn't change a lot. We also have a guest tonight. In the person of the world famous internet fame, Martin Wimpress. Good evening, Martin.
Good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me back on.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So, Martin, to paraphrase a podcast that I listen to every week, what have you been up to since last time we spoke?
I have been remaining mostly indoors.
That's the safest way.
Yeah, it feels like a lifetime ago. I was a bit shocked when you said it was only March the last time we did this. It feels like it was at least a year ago.
Yes, I know. You need to come back more often on this show.
And in fact, this is another good opportunity for a little bit of social contact apart from anything else, right? This is the new way of mingling with your friends, it turns out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So in this episode, we're going to review the fourth episode of Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Forget Me Not. And I'm sure we're going to have a nice talk about the series with Martin afterwards. So if you guys don't have anything to add to this lengthy introduction, I propose that we go on with our review of Forget Me Not. So in the teaser, USS Discovery floats in space as DOT-7 drones repair the ship. Dr. Hugh Culbert conducts examinations of the crew, who are still processing the leap forward in time. He finds them physically well, but psychologically stressed. In a voiceover log entry, he notes that the ship's goal of searching out the remaining Federation members has provided motivation for some crew members, while leaving others detached. He offers to talk to Kayla Detmer, who is taking it harder than many on the ship, but she declines. I thought it was weird that he would walk around the ship to do the exams. I would have, expected that they would come to sickbay.
I suppose when you have a large number of people that all need to go to the same place at the same time, it might be slightly more efficient to have the least number of people moving.
Yeah, I guess. For the series, for the screen too, I guess it's a lot better to have a few move around the ship rather than have everyone come to the same place.
It's a bit like lockdown, really.
Yeah. Yes, exactly that. He also seems to be taking on the role of counselor as well.
Yeah. Well, someone has to do that, you know. And when there's no proper counselor, I guess the doctor is the next best thing.
Mm, I suppose so.
And this is uncharted territory because they have sort of, leapt forward nearly a millennia in time. So they're going to feel a little bit, well, not a little bit, they're going to feel very detached from everything. Everything's going to be unfamiliar and uncomfortable.
Yeah, I guess. Sometimes I sleep too much and I'm completely lost for my day. So, Adira undergoes medical scans in attempts to retrieve her memories from the Thal symbiont. Culbert and Dr. Tracy Pollard find that the symbiont is wrapped around Adira's heart, which she says is to protect her. She remembers nothing of her life before the joining. Noting that she can remember how to speak 7 languages and make a Bajoran aspirat, whatever that is, but her earliest memory is being in an escape pod before being rescued by the United Earth Defense Force. Culbert suggests that they travel to Trill to seek the help of experts on the symbiont, and Adira agrees. But that was just after suggesting that he would poke into her brain and try to get the memories out.
Yeah.
I'm not super familiar with this whole symbiont and Trill thing. There's only one Trill I remember from Star Trek of the past, and that was Dax. Mm-hmm. And this whole symbiont thing must have passed me by because, you know, I didn't realize this was a thing at all.
They don't speak too much of the symbiont in DS9. I think there's a few episodes where they, well, I guess the first time we see Dax, because Sisko was friend with the previous hosts, I think, or one of the previous hosts. That's why Sisko calls Dax old man all the time, mm-hmm. even though mm-hmm. she's obviously not a man. But yeah, they don't really speak about that a lot. So yeah, I was surprised that the crew of Discovery already knew about the Trills, because I thought the Federation discovered the Trills after that, but it's not very clear. I know there's a reference to the Trill in Next Gen. We talked about that last week, didn't we?
We did, yes.
Yes. I don't remember. Maybe Saru said he got the information from the Sphere data. Don't remember exactly. But they seem to know quite a lot about, not a lot, but they seem to know stuff about the Trill that they probably shouldn't.
Potentially, yes. First of my many quotes of the week this week was Adira saying, "Have I always been a genius?"
She also referred to the symbiote as a squid.
Yes. I think that might be a bit later on, but yes, she did. And
okay.
That was quite amusing.
Yeah, I guess it was a good thing no Trill was there.
Yeah, I'd imagine they would have taken that as quite an insult, I guess, to have their... Well, they're revered, aren't they, the symbionts? Yeah. They're revered because of the... We learn later on that it's actually an honour to be joined with a symbiont. So, well, we'll get into a bit more of that later on,
yeah,
about the quirks of joining. This is the first time that I've noticed that the medical team have the Red Cross emblem on their comm badges. Yeah. Does that make me a bad person?
No.
No?
I didn't even notice it.
not even this time.
Ever since they've come forward to the time they're in now, I've been taking very special note to the different comm badges, particularly for those people who were former Starfleet. And we actually meet quite a few former Starfleet people later on in the episode towards the end. And they all have different uniforms and different comm badges of different eras. So I'm always on the lookout to see what the comm badges look like. And yeah, the Red Cross, as in the International Red Cross, they have openly admitted that they're using an inverted Swiss flag.
Of course. Well, it's...
And that's what they intended it to be. I have in front of me a Swiss comm badge.
Oh, where did you get that?
Well, a good friend sent it to me.
Oh.
But I didn't realise that it was actually a thing. I thought you just made this because... It was the Swiss flag, and it looked really cool.
I did. I didn't know
so
it
you
existed.
Didn't, you didn't know it's actually a combat design?
Nope.
So I'll put this here.
I don't think Discovery existed when I sent that to you.
So where did you spot this?
So during that initial scene when Culber was going through the crew and seeing how they were and checking on their vital signs and the like, some of that scene was actually took place in medical, in sick bay. And I noticed that there was at least one, possibly two, of the medical staff actually had speaking roles in that scene. And one of them had the standard Discovery comm badge with the cross on it. And I'm like, I didn't even know that was a thing. Mm-hmm. I knew about the Section 31 comm badge.
The black ones.
Well, I spotted that...
The black one.
What's the original captain's name? From an alternate universe, who's now an admiral.
Yes.
You know who I'm referring to. I forget her name.
Giorgio.
Giorgio, there we go. She had a different comm badge on when she was wearing her admiral's uniform. Like the week before. Yeah. So that was the first time I spotted there was a difference in comm badges because hers was different.
I didn't notice.
Okay. I have to go back and watch that again.
Yeah. Me too. Right, so we're on Act 1. Using the Spore Drive, Discovery jumps to Trill and goes to Yellow Alert, wary after their reception at Earth. They open a channel to the planet and receive a holographic reply from Commissioner Voss, who says the Trill population was decimated by the burn and is excited to encounter a returning symbiont. Captain Saru says he will send the host and a medical officer to the planet, though he does not mention Adira is human, not Trill. How does that work? How can they receive a holographic response when Discovery is probably not equipped with whatever is necessary to receive that response?
Maybe they don't have to be. If the technology is already available in that time, then I don't think it would be too big a jump to... We've seen this before in TNG, where somebody has appeared as an apparition, for want of a better word, on the bridge. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that 930-something years later they could do that.
That's a lot of backwards compatibility, isn't it, with some protocols?
It is that.
I would argue that in TNG, whenever someone appeared as a holographic something or a projection on the bridge, it was not a communication. It was often a superior being or an alien race. But here, I guess it could be the same. I guess it could work like that.
And was it last week or the week before when we... In fact, it was last week because that's when we first met Adira. When Ndoye said, a view screen, how quaint.
Yeah. How can she know?
But if she knew that, why didn't she use whatever technology she had in order to appear as a hologram on the bridge of the Discovery?
Good question. You know, they send a Discover packet, and then the packet responds view screen, and then... Yeah, geeky stuff.
I wonder why Saru didn't mention that Adira was human.
Did they know that that was relevant at that point? I mean, are they aware enough that that's an issue for the Trills?
I agree. I don't think that was relevant to them.
Relevant to whom?
To Saru and...
Well, as in Starfleet didn't realise that a symbiont being hosted by a non-Trill would be an issue.
No. No, absolutely. But I'm curious as to why the review specifically called out the fact that Saru didn't mention that she was human. Whether it was kind of reading ahead as a way of paving...
Yeah, I think so.
Paving the way to understanding why the Trill reacted the way they did in a later scene, which we've not spoken about yet.
Yeah, I don't see any other explanation than what Martin said. That
it
was not relevant. So why tell everyone the sun is yellow when everybody knows the sun is yellow?
And also, we didn't, you know, the Trill were explaining how precious the symbionts were now because of the burn. Maybe 1,000-year-old knowledge about, you know, symbionts being hosted by non-Trill isn't as pertinent based on their understanding as it is now in the future.
Yeah. In engineering, Saru approaches Paul Stamets to discuss his health, and more broadly, the risks posed by having a single person capable of operating the Spore Drive, especially with the era's dilithium scarcity. Yeah, I guess, you know, you never have... It's never good to have only one person able to do a critical task. You need at least two of them.
Not that particular task as well.
Yeah. Stamets is defensive, noting he researched the matter for more than a decade before the discovery of the tardigrade aboard the USS Glenn allowed him to make control jumps. Saru notes there has been over 900 years of technological developments since then and that alternatives are necessary in the event Stamets should ever again be incapacitated.
I'm confused by that particular statement because we're already aware of the fact that with the burn having occurred 120, whatever it was, years ago, many groups of people have looked and researched into alternatives to dilithium in warp drive. So Saru saying here that there have been over 900 years of technological development, I think was a bit of a daft thing to say because we already know there's no alternative to warp at the moment.
And don't we know that the whole spore drive thing kind of died in the past, right? That was buried. That technology has effectively been lost to history, except for this relic that now exists in the future. So it's it may be 1,000 years old, but it's actually the cutting edge of technology because it just doesn't exist anywhere in the current timeline.
Working on the assumption that the agreement that Pike and his crew made before yeah. they left Discovery held out, yes, yeah. absolutely.
And they were lucky that the how they call that the network they're using to jump
mycelial
mm-hmm. network is still existing. I mean, could have been destroyed by the burn too.
Yeah. Now, what Saru could have been alluding to is after 1,000 years, perhaps computer technology has moved on, or artificial intelligence has moved on to a degree where you could have a non-human pilot for the spore drive.
Yes, good call.
It's the infinite number of monkeys with an infinite number of, I don't know, insert some witty Star Trek reference here.
Antentili says she has been developing a new interface for the spore drive utilizing dark matter, but Stamets is immediately dismissive and tells her not to waste his time.
That angered me.
Yeah, it was a bit rude. I mean, she was just trying to help.
Yeah.
But then I guess it was, you know, paving the way for what happens later on. But
absolutely, it does. I kind of got a little bit of an insight into how Stamets' brain is working with relation to his role on Discovery. If he reinforces the fact that he is the only person that is capable of running or acting as interface to the spore drive, which is something he does say later on specifically, then he's trying to effectively render himself indispensable.
Yes.
He is the only person. He is needed. He is wanted. He is the lifeblood. He's almost like building up this kind of superiority complex of how important he is on this ship.
Yeah, well, not on this ship, but maybe even an integral part of the ship.
Yeah.
That's a good shout, yes. Because at that point, when he's working and he's part interface with the drive, he is the ship.
Yes.
Kelber visits Burnham in her quarters as she reviews clues about the burn that she collected during her year alone. Kelber asks Burnham to accompany Adira on the planet to provide emotional support, since she has experienced a similar feeling of disorientation and loss. Kelber describes post-traumatic growth, a means by which people can grow and evolve after a difficult life event, like nearly dying or being isolated. Yeah, we do know about that. Burnham worries she wouldn't be able to function in this role, but he calls her a responsibility hoarder who focuses on work during times of emotional struggles. Yeah, and he said that, you know, even when she's struggling herself, she's trying to save every living thing in the galaxy, literally.
Yes, that's a very good phrase, responsibility hoarder. I relate to that one myself a little bit. But from Burnham's perspective, she does seem to be trying to solve all the universe's problems in one go.
Yeah.
And she, yeah, it's not sustainable.
Oh, no. Which is why I tend to stay away from any kind of responsibilities.
I tell you what, it's not a bad approach to take. Okay, here's a question for you. So Kolber is carrying out, probably at this moment in time, one of the most important tasks that he needs to do. He is going around and he's checking to make sure that everybody is okay because they've all been through a trauma.
Mm-hmm.
What about him? Because not only has he gone through this trauma, he's gone through this trauma with Stamets. And let's not forget, he'd also come out of the back of a trauma himself not long since in season 2.
Mm-hmm.
So is he even qualified to act as counselor to the rest of the crew after everything he's been through?
On the face of it, he seems to be doing a decent job at the moment. I mean, maybe he has been trained in this. He seems to be asking the right questions. He seems to be very self-aware. So maybe he's been able to guard himself as he's come through. Because as you say, you know, the end of season 2 and what he was subjected to, because technically, you know, he was killed and then magically transported into an alternate was it a reality or time zone or something?
Yeah, it was whatever the... Because didn't the Discovery end up kind of caught in this rift?
The rift.
In both realities at the same time.
And, you know, he'd clearly been there for a long time. It was physically and mentally exhausting, I'm sure. So, yeah, I think we're being persuaded to sort of conveniently forget his difficult past at this point. But he seems composed and in control right now.
Yeah, it seemed like that ever since he came back. I mean, this character is not the same as it was at the beginning of the series. So I guess
when he came back, he was not as emotional.
Yes, that's exactly. So I would say that maybe his past experience made him the right person, as you know, he's now very focused and he knows what the others are going through because he already experienced that.
So he's sort of elevated to a sort of a higher state.
Yeah.
Something's just come back into my head. Isn't Culbert Trigger's broom at the moment? Wasn't he regenerated from something? Sorry, Trigger's broom, for your benefit, Yannick. It's a joke from Only Fools and Horses, where Trigger said he's been using the same broom for 10 years, but it's had 13 new heads and 6 new handles, but it's exactly the same broom as it was when it started. But no, I thought Culbert he was kind of obliterated and reformed.
Yeah, something like that.
Because I'm pretty certain that when he reappeared in season 2, and Stamets was trying to get through to him and trying to remind him of the life that they had before that incident happened, I'm sure there was something that said that this actually wasn't the same Culbert that we knew physically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember now.
I don't recall, but I remember enough for me to say that, yes, I think you're probably right in that regard.
Ooh. Ooh. Thank you.
You get one Davies right.
That
tonight.
Doesn't happen often.
As they approach the shuttle bay, Adira questions why Bonham is accompanying her to Trill and decides to go alone. However, after a few seconds, she changes her mind, saying she does not wish to let anyone down. Boarding Shuttlecraft 31, Adira also urges Burnham not to say anything annoyingly inspirational, to which Burnham laughs and agrees. I think this shuttle black and red? It was not the same shuttle as the other ones. Or am I imagining things?
I don't pay that enough attention to the shuttlecraft to answer that question, yeah. I'm afraid.
I've been watching a few TNG episodes, but...
Shuttlecraft 31 is black and red.
Yes. Okay, so I didn't dream that. So why is this one black and red and the other ones are white?
It's not 31 because Section 31, is it?
Ah, could be.
No, because it is a... it's attached to Discovery. It's DSC 31 is its call sign.
Maybe it's just, you know, a thing the writers or the guys who shot the movies made, you know, just in reference to Section 31, just to annoy us viewers.
Oh, actually, some of the other ones are black and red as well.
Are they? Okay.
Shuttlecraft 6 is.
Maybe we just never saw any black and red Shuttlecraft.
Not a clue. I've got to say, my ability to go to Memory Alpha and look things up on the fly is getting so good.
Yeah,
Shuttlecraft 1 was black and red as well.
Okay. You could have added that to your CV, you know. Can search Memory Alpha in a few seconds.
Yeah, forget
sure
Google.
That information would actually help me. Yeah, forget Google. So another quote of the week, or quote of the week potential, because I haven't actually chosen one this week. I've just picked out all the good ones. When Adira said to Burnham, "Look, I have a squid and you threw up in a wormhole."
Yeah. We're equal to now.
In the captain's ready room, Culbert delivers his report to Saru. The crew is physically sound, but not healthy. They are experiencing high anxiety due to their solitary circumstances. Saru wants to help, but the typical Starfleet remedies of duty and routine may not be effective, Culbert says. Because Discovery is unknown in 3189, the crew needs to feel connected. Which is exactly what
what's his name in Avengers, and when the Samuel L. Jackson's character,
Nick Fury.
Yeah, Nick Fury said to the Avengers when they were kind of not working together, and he faked, was it Carter's death? He found something to you, connect them, and then they worked in team. So I guess it's a universal way to make people work together and feel better.
Mm.
They have a common goal.
I found that a little bit cold, that statement about, a bit of routine and hard work, that'll knock the whimsy out of them and get them back in shape. I felt like that was deliberately off mark, but I was a bit surprised by that because it was a bit like, nose to the grindstone and everything will be fine.
But that was Saru that said that, wasn't it?
It was.
So that could just be one of not many examples of Saru demonstrating that he is actually really new in command.
Perhaps.
He may not have all the experience that a long-term captain like Picard or Pike or whomever has got, that they could potentially rile up some form of inspirational speech. It's like, oh, let's duty. Actually, Picard of the early 24th century probably would have gone down the role of duty and routine.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
the almost 25th century, numbers just throw me out every time. But the Picard era Picard would be more like, let's look at the person under the skin.
Yeah, I guess it's one of the chapters in, Captaincy for the Dummies.
Yes, which we have mentioned before.
On Trill, Burnham and Adira land and walk through a lush forest where flying fish leap from ponds. It's like the first episode when we saw those two insects, in the front. It has nothing to do with the story, but it just adds a kind of feeling that it's
they had some CGI burnt budget to burn.
It was funny because you can see this thing jump out of the water and back in, and I was thinking, oh, that's a nice fish, and then it flies, and the fish don't fly.
Flying fish do.
Yeah, well, they don't really fly, do they? They just
they don't.
Jump very, very, very far. But this one has had wings, so is it a fish? Is it a bird?
It's a parrotfish.
Can it leap tall buildings in a single bound?
Maybe.
It'd be surprising what 930-something years can do to evolution.
They encounter Voss along with Guardian Z and Leader Pav, among others. Panham introduces herself and Adira. The Trill are confounded to see a non-Trill host. Z asks Adira to speak her names, but she can only respond with Adira. Voss notes there is no record in over 2,000 years of a successful joining between a symbiont and a non-Trill species, and calls Adira's joining with Tal an abomination. That was harsh. That was not friendly at all.
It was a little bit nasty.
Yeah, I was surprised because I didn't realize that the Trill were that against non-Trill joining. But I guess what they explain later on explains that.
Yeah, it's their culture, it's their manner of being, isn't it? That the symbionts are, they're a Trill thing.
Yeah.
And to have essentially an alien come along and manage to almost successfully join with one of their symbionts, it's gonna knock them out a bit.
And also sort of the endangered status of symbionts now as well.
Yeah, because in the past, in previous series, they were not that against, a human being joined. It's just that it's not something that is usually sustainable for both the symbiont and the human, but they were not, they wouldn't call that abomination. In Next Gen, I think we said last week, Riker was joined with a Trill, with a symbiont, wasn't he? I think we said that.
That does ring bells, yes.
Yes. So I guess I was surprised, but then we had an explanation just a few seconds later.
Voss suggests excising the symbiont, though Z-Worm's forced separation would kill the host, alarming Burnham. Z apologizes and explains that Trill society and the population of Trill who could be joined was devastated by the burn and its aftermath, with the survival of their culture through joining in doubt. He says symbionts joining with humans could be a solution to their problem. Pav decides that they will not forcibly remove the symbiont, but agrees with Voss that the joining is an aberration. She orders Adira and Burnham to leave the planet immediately. So that's the explanation, in fact. That's because they now have very little trail capable of joining, that having a host joined with a human, that's one less trail that is that could be granted this honor of being joined.
But it's the closed-mindedness of the Trill leader, Pav, isn't it, that effectively shut out the possibility that a human being could join with the symbionts and help. They're thinking about what it means for them in the now rather than what it could mean for Trill society in the future. Yep. And the one thing I notice with Z is the way he approached it, and the way that he was questioning, and the way that he was reacting, at this point in the first viewing, I was of the impression that he was actually going to try and help them.
Yes, yeah. He was much more empathetic, wasn't he?
Yes,
yes, but he was thinking of the big picture as well.
I also struggled getting past the fact that I just thought he was Jim from Neighbours the whole time. But other than that, he wasn't. It's not that actor, but.
Jim Robbins, that was Alan Dale, wasn't it? Yeah, he popped up in something we were watching the other day, and I thought, I recognise him. He said, yeah, Jim from Neighbours.
Yeah, he usually plays an evil senator in political dramas in America these days. He's sort of typecast into
yes.
this. Sort of.
Yes.
All right, so we are in Act 2. As Benham and Adira walk away from the meeting towards their shuttle, they are accosted by Voss and two men with bladed weapons. They prepare to kill Adira to recover the symbiont, but Burnham pulls out a phaser and stuns the two guards. Voss refuses to tell her where to find the caves of Makala, and Burnham stuns him as well, which Adira notes is not Federation protocol. No, it's not. And I was surprised that's at this point when I was watching that I reacted in the Telegram group. I don't know if you remember.
I do, yes.
Because at this point you'd... I mean, there's no indication that they were stunned or killed. She just pulled out her gun and shot them. And she shot Voss point blank. So I was like, whoa.
Everything she'd done up to that point was reasonable.
Yeah.
But with Voss, that was just a... I'm not going to say unprovoked, because obviously they were in fear of their safety. But she could have dealt with that a different way that didn't involve firing something at him and shooting him 6 feet across the floor.
Yeah, yeah, I was really surprised. But yeah, you know, it's the new Burnham. She spent a year on this planet alone, and she had to learn how to get the information and get away from strange situations.
As we said before, she's become a lot less Vulcan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Z approaches them and offers to show the caves.
Called it.
Yeah. Well, she almost got shot.
Yeah.
It was that close. On Discovery, Saru consults the computer as to how to heal his crew. The computer's voice changes and it chuckles. It recommends silent film comedies by Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. Saru, perplexed, orders it to perform a level 10 diagnostic. But the computer replies that it is fully operational. The computer also suggests giving the crew a night off and inviting them to a meal. Now, Saru didn't seem that surprised. You know, the computer suddenly changed, chuckles, says "I," but it goes on as if everything was normal.
Did you spot what was happening over his shoulder when this exchange?
Yeah.
Yeah. Something's going on here, right?
Yeah. On the view screen,
yeah.
It changed for a second,
yeah.
And the sphere appeared.
So the sphere was sort of demonstrably on screen, and as he turned around, it vanished.
Yeah.
And this, and while it was on screen, was when the computer was maybe demonstrating a more human means of interaction.
You know, we've met her before, don't you?
Have we?
Have we?
Oh, okay. Zora from the Short Treks episode Calypso.
Huh. Well, I've not watched those, so okay.
Ah, okay.
Is it Zora?
Apparently it is. Zora is what became of the sphere data, or the the consciousness of the sphere data. So I'm told.
Yeah, when I saw that, I thought, oh, but that reminds me of a Short Trek, and I went there, and I said, no, it's the Calypso, it's not Discovery. So I just dismissed it. But yeah, it reminded me of that.
I don't think we ever know what timeline Calypso is set. Sorry, what time span Calypso is set. No. It actually appeared in the notes for the review.
Oh, okay, I didn't read the notes.
That it was the same consciousness.
How did they know that? I mean,
so it sounds like I need to go and watch these Short Treks then. So that sounds like there's something for me to catch up on there.
Some of them are good.
I haven't watched them all yet.
So I tell you what, this is a quick discussion point. Is there, are we therefore to assume that this interaction is friendly, or do we think there's any malice in this revised version of the computer?
That gets addressed later
on.
Oh,
it does. Okay.
Something that Saru said
at the end, yes.
At the end, the of his opinion of this was
right.
Yeah. But we're gonna talk about that again when we reach that point.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have stuff to say.
Good. Great question though.
Mm-hmm. On Trill, Z leads Burnham and Adira to the sacred pools in the caves of Makala. He notes that as the symbiont's ancestral home, it is the most likely place for it to communicate with Adira, who says the caves feel safe. Adira asks Burnham to say something inspirational before she enters the pools. Michael tells her to get in there before someone shoots us.
Wow. That's so inspiring.
Yeah. I mean,
it's more motivational than inspiring, that one.
I mean, it deserves a poster to put on the wall, you know, get in there before someone shoots us.
Yeah.
Saru hosts a dinner party in his ready room. He announces he has given the rest of the crew the evening off, and that the dinner for the bridge crew is to be a ritual to take the measure of loved ones and what we've all accomplished together. He reminds the crew of the small prayer they said before they leaped into the future. Aye, though Philippa Giorgio playfully notes that she did not cast such a vote. They toast one another again, saying aye. Yeah, I guess Giorgio was fighting control at the time. She was fighting control when they jumped, not when they decided to join Michael. So
I can't remember where she was.
Can't remember. But yeah, apparently she didn't cast a vote.
Well, maybe she wouldn't have cast a vote because I've made a note here that despite the fact that Giorgio was being a bit of a butt about it, that scene was actually really moving. And the fact that if you look throughout this episode, everything that tried to bring people together, she was the one individual that stood out, that refused to engage with this recitation of the prayer. Later on, there's a particular social scene that she almost manages to get away with not partaking in. And it's just entirely possible that being who she is and where she's come from, that this whole idea of getting an agreement or just sound of affirmation from each member of the crew to say, yes, we will go with you through the void. And she just would not have partaken because that's not her thing.
Yeah, she just doesn't care.
Yeah, basically.
In the cave, Burnham asks if Adira may have been joined against her will. Z says symbionts cannot survive in an unwilling host, and that Adira must face whatever the issue is. Adira, dressed in a traditional white gown, that they have specifically her size just right there, walks into the pool.
For a few moments, Adira floats on her back, and as sparks dance across the water surface, her eyes flash fully white. Adira is now in communion with the symbiont. That's the weird part of the episode. That's the you know, when I saw that, I was well, we're going to go, you know, mythical, or, you know, something weird is going to happen. And bingo! Yeah, so they just happened to have whatever, you know, size of clothes for her. So I guess they have a whole pile of stuff there, back there, just in case someone comes in.
Well, I don't think that's unreasonable. I mean, the Trill appear to be whatever that word is that means they are human-like.
They're fully signed up to the toga party, though. I mean, one toga size fits all, right?
Pretty much. Although this seemed to be a fitted gown with, like, arms and whatever, so you'd have to worry about the width of the person.
It just doesn't reach your ankles. You know, the broader you are, the higher up your calves and knees.
That is just so brazen.
It's the voice of experience.
Do not display your ankles in public. Something from that, when Z said that symbionts cannot survive in an unwilling host. Well, it occurs to me that Adira didn't even know she had a symbiont.
Yes, she did.
So how should be considered a willing host? I know this gets addressed later on.
I was going to say, I couldn't remember the order, so I wasn't sure. Yeah.
Yeah, this gets addressed later on.
She knows she has a symbiont. We've seen that on the scans.
Yes, but at the time she didn't. When we met her last week.
Oh, you're right. Yes, now I remember. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't until it was the beginning of this episode that we discovered the symbiont wrapped around her heart.
No,
so
because
last week's episode.
Last week's episode, she said she was a Tal. She said she was the...
She was Senatal, but she couldn't explain why. Mm. She didn't know she had a symbiont. She just knew she had these memories. So she can't be considered a willing host if she doesn't even know she has this thing joined to her.
Yes, at this point, that is accurate.
No, I disagree. Yeah,
with that caveat, yes.
No, there's nothing that says she didn't know. There's also nothing that says she did, but nothing. There's nothing that we saw last week that says she didn't know.
But it was this episode when she said, uttered the immortal words, which should go down in history in perpetuity, I have a squid.
Yeah, but it was not a surprise. I didn't take that as a surprise. Because last week, Saru said she's a Trill, and Trill are a joint species. So,
pardon?
Yeah. Last week, when Saru told Michael that Adira was a Trill, he said it's a joint species. So I'm pretty sure she knew she had a squid.
I don't remember that.
I didn't take this exam and then the fact that she said she had a squid around her heart as a revelation to her.
I don't remember Saru saying that they knew she was a Trill.
It's in the... last time on Discovery part of the episode.
I don't recall this. I have to go back and watch again, I think.
Yeah. So, well, it might be that she didn't know, but I'm pretty sure she knew. She didn't seem surprised when she said that she had a squid. But, yeah, you know, what do I know?
Because if she was getting trickles of the memories of the previous hosts through... We know this because she knew that in some way, possibly without even being able to explain it, that she was Senatal. So possibly when she saw that she was with Squid, as I think I said later on in the episode, with Symbiont, that it wasn't a surprise to her because actually deep down in her repressed memory, she did know that.
Yeah,
as herself, she didn't. But I'm happy to be proved wrong because it is a regular thing.
Let's agree on the fact that we don't agree.
I can do that.
Yep. At Saru's dinner party, the crew eats quietly. Kelber inquires about the tension between Stamets and Tilly, but Stamets deflects the inquiry. Saru tells the story of his life on Kaminar, and the crew pivots to playing a game where they try to speak in haiku.
This was so funny.
Yeah.
Absolutely hilarious listening.
Yes.
Culber gets it wrong.
Yeah.
And then Tilly's just was not suitable for the dinner table.
Yeah. Detmer refuses to participate at first before starting to form a haiku about Stamets' blood. She refuses to stop as Stamets protests and the rest watch awkwardly. He cites his rapid return to duty after being injured, but Detmer argues that all of their jobs are important. Tilly enters the fray and tells them to be united as a crew. Stamets and Culber walk out, followed by Detmer, then the rest. I didn't understand really why she would start a haiku about Stamets' blood, except, yeah, you know, that she had a grudge against him, but...
I don't know.
At first, I didn't really understood that, but I guess it was too...
I think she's exhibiting some kind of stress here, and this is not a conscious choice. This is, you know, the overspilling of emotion and, you know, the mind running away with itself.
The way she laughed was a good indication that she was not really...
She's been acting, you know, off for, I think that there, I forget exactly what the scenario was, but there was some kind of incursion where she sustained an injury and she was checked out at that point and she didn't look right and she's not been right since that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the beginning of episode 2 when Discovery landed on the planet that held the colony.
Right.
And she was thrown over the console at the point of landing. Everybody was knocked out or something.
And she's been off her game since then.
Yeah. And she's right in this scene. She said that she landed Discovery, and that's true. That's what she did. She's the pilot of the ship, as she mentioned. And she's got a very tough job. And I guess, you know, regarding what you said earlier about Stamets, you know, thinking that he's one of the most important person on the ship, if not the ship itself. I can understand that she was upset.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good way to, you know, kill the mood at the dinner party.
But the way she did it, the way she reacted to it, it was probably 2.5 steps away from a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
That's the way it came across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, I mean, going back to what I said back in episode 2 when I predicted that possibly Detmer was suffering from an invasion of control. I don't know. I'm kind of thinking beyond that now. I think maybe this is purely a stress related thing, and that the fact that she and Stamets are loggerheads with each other anyway, that just catalyzed one huge great explosion between the two of them.
Yep. Yeah, but I'm going to have to add something about that later on at the end of this review.
I'm keeping my prediction, though.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not dismissing the prediction.
Which prediction is this?
That I think that Detmer has been infected somehow by control.
Ah.
Because I think it was last week I pointed back to Arium.
Yes.
From season 2 that was jettisoned into space in order to protect the sphere data because she'd been infected with the control virus because she was android, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Arium?
Yeah.
Whereas Detmer is augmented, that it's entirely probable that some part of her has been infected by control, either prior to what happened at the end of season 2, or maybe even as a result of what happened at the end of season 2.
We shall see.
One of the funniest moments in that scene, and don't get me wrong, it wasn't a funny scene at all, it was meant to be deadly serious. Saru picks a particular moment to have a go at Tilly for calling them assholes. Rather than actually trying to step in to stop what was was forming, because it was getting big at that point.
Yeah, I guess maybe he didn't know how to react to what was going on, but Tilly saying those words, he knew how to react to that, and then his instinct just took over and say, you know, there's something going on. I can't manage that. I don't know how to do. Oh, here's something I can do. Let's do that and try and, you know, and try and take control back by this thing that I can manage and then see what's going on.
Yeah, but it fits because Saru has taken on the role of father figure to Tilly.
Yeah.
And it would be the natural thing if your child said a rude word, don't say that rude word.
Yeah. Don't do what daddy does, you know.
I think there's both of those arguments hold water, right? There's a little bit of parental guidance there, and there's also control what you can control. And maybe Saru was feeling a little out of his depth as all of his sort of senior crew were losing control.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also in this scene was my quote of the week when Giorgio left the room and said, at least the wine is good, and then went away with the bottle.
With the bottle, yes.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant, yes.
She's definitely one of my favourite characters this season, no question.
I like her a lot more this season than previous.
Yeah, season. She's not so fighty and a little bit more dry humour and witty.
Yeah.
Oh, just realised there was no Reno in this episode.
No, true.
Talking about dry wit.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Meanwhile, on Trill, Adira is in distress. Burnham attempts to enter the pool, but Pav, Vos, and several guards enter and stop her. Adira begins to hyperventilate and twitch in the pool before disappearing beneath the milky liquid. Pav reluctantly agrees to let Burnham enter. The Trill deploy neural stabilizers to allow her to commune with Adira for a short time. Those looked like, you know, sticks with electricity in them. And I was wondering...
Cattle prods.
Cattle prods, yes.
Yeah, something like that. I was thinking, that's not going to end well.
No. Well, her eyes went white, the same as Adira's did.
Yeah, they obviously went rummaging around in the Marvel special effects department for storms, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, that's an easy effect with Photoshop. You just put some white on the eyes and then you're done.
Yeah. I was curious as to how she was able to do that when she didn't have a symbiont.
Yeah. There's a lot of strange stuff in these caves, like here, how she was able to do that, and later on come back on that, but yeah, some kind of shortcuts, maybe creative shortcuts.
There are other symbionts in that water, though, right? You don't enter the water with a symbiont in you already. That is their natural habitat. So, is it possible that the other symbiont? Because I remember, you know, these things have cropped up. I just don't remember very well, but those caves have been in earlier or different episodes of Star Trek episodes. And they were swimming around.
Yeah, I think we saw one or two in this one.
Right.
In this episode.
So maybe they are able to sort of facilitate the connection.
Maybe, yeah.
I thought the caves were their ancestral home.
That's right.
Yes.
More than where they actually were. I wasn't even aware that there were symbionts in the caves, in the lake.
I think we see one or two.
My understanding is that this not all Trill, but let's say believers. I don't understand the cult. I don't remember the culture, but Trill care for these caves in order to nurture the symbionts that then, you know, enter a host at some point. You know, that is their calling, if you like, to sort of be their protectors and carers.
I think I remember something like that, yes.
Yeah.
So, on to Act 3. Burnham finds herself in a strange place with colourful threads floating through the air. She finds Adira, who says she's trapped and confused. One of the threads touches Adira's foot, and she reacts with pain.
If she remains in one place for more than a few seconds, the threads attack her. Burnham surmises Adira is in this place to connect with her symbiont, and that the threads are attempting to connect with her, not harm her, that they are connected to the symbiont's memories.
How can she know that? I mean, she just arrived, she saw some thread and said, ooh, it must be you, symbiont.
So this is the bit that I was talking about earlier about a symbiont not being able to survive without a willing host. I suppose from a human perspective, fear and possibly a lack of understanding would lead you to instinctively reject attempts by the symbiont to connect with them.
Yeah.
So the whole willing host thing is that Trill instinctively or educationally know about the symbionts and how they work and what they represent and presumably how they will try and connect with a Trill host. Whereas human standard response is, what's that?
Yeah.
So in that respect, a human wouldn't be a willing host unless they'd had somebody to explain to them what it was. And for the purposes of this instance, that was Burnham. How? I don't know. Like you quite rightly said, how did she have that knowledge to say, this is what's supposed to happen?
Yeah.
Unless she's got a symbiont. That would explain the eyes.
Yes, maybe. Now back to Adira not being a willing host. We learn later on that she was a willing host, actually. So anything, you know, even if she don't remember, she was a willing host, as we're going to see very soon.
She became a willing host.
Yeah. At the point she was joined, she was willing to be joined.
Yes. At the point that she actually made a connection, she was willing. But up to that point, she wasn't.
Yeah, no. Well, as we will see very soon. Adira allows multiple threads to connect with her fingertips. Suddenly, she accesses a memory of herself in a medical bay standing over her lover, Gray, a Trill about to receive the symbiont. In the memory, they hold hands and Adira wonders whether Gray will be the same after the joining. In the thread space, Adira tells Burnham that she and Gray were both orphans aboard a generation ship, searching for a Federation headquarters. Stressed, Adira tries to walk away, but Burnham tells her she cannot leave until she accesses the full memory. That's a lie. She wants her to stay there because she wants her answer.
Yeah. I wish to apologize in advance. I need to give you an idea of where my mind went at this point.
Okay.
I thought that possibly the symbiont got to where it was because of biological material transfer.
That's not how it works.
I know that now. Well, I know that later on. But I honestly thought because of how they were representing Adira and Gray as lovers, and they were clearly madly in love with each other, and he adored her, that possibly that it was, you know, biological transfer. Not to be too crass about it. But, so I do apologize, but I have to be honest, that's kind of where I went.
Yeah, well, no. In her memory, Adira sees Gray, now joined with the Tal symbiont, playing cello in their quarters. She tells Gray that he promised he would be the same after the joining, but that his newly gained skills made him kind of perfect. Gray jokes that he already was perfect, but insists he is still himself, just more so. However, Adira questions what is truly Gray and what comes from the prior hosts. Yeah, that's a good question, actually. Is a Trill host still that host, which is what they say all the time, that they're still themselves, but they have the memories of the others?
I don't know. It's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Dax always portrayed herself as her, and yet Sisko always spoke to her as an old friend. So he was clearly addressing somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. And it was even more like that when Jadzia died and Erza took over the symbiont. She didn't want to have anything to do with Sisko or the previous host's memories. She wanted to be herself. So yeah, good question. Are you still the same person when you suddenly have memories of, in this case, I think it was 5 or 6 previous hosts?
Yeah.
Is it still you when you suddenly know how to play the cello? I don't know. It's a good question. I think it's a philosophical question and we're not fit to answer that.
No, but we can have opinions.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we did. I have a lot of those.
When Adira willingly allowed herself to connect with the Symbian when Burnham, you know, said, this is what you need to do, we first saw Gray playing cello.
Mm-hmm.
In the thread space, I think they call it, yeah, her face lit up under the skin.
Yeah.
Quite similar to what Book was doing in episode 1.
That's true.
I don't know whether it was the same patterning, because his patterning was a lot more defined, whereas Adira's was more of a glowing with accented pieces. So I'm not convinced it's the same thing.
I feel like the visual effects department have learned a new trick there, and they have adapted it for a different purpose.
That's possible.
It's like they've just gone out and licensed a huge piece of software that's cost them an absolute fortune. They've got to get their money's worth from it.
Yeah, we're going to make everyone's forehead glow at least once in the series.
Mine's doing it now, can you see?
Yeah, mine too. Look at that. Yeah, I'm glowing. Adira marvels that he is able to navigate the joining so well, and he assures her the joining is based on trust between symbiont and host, just as he trusts Adira. She presents him with a handmade art gift, but as Gray opens the box, Adira pulls out of the memory, telling Burnham to back off. She accuses Burnham of being interested only in the message from Senatal, but Burnham says her interest is in securing a future for everyone and that Adira will never move forward without facing whatever painful memory she is suppressing. Liar, you just want information.
Class.
Yeah.
Did you notice that Gray actually referred to the symbiont by name?
Tal, yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So, if the hosts are adopting the name as part of their identity, that would mean that Senatal was originally called Senna.
Yep. As Jadzia Dax was originally called Jadzia.
I've not seen that, so I don't know.
Trilla only have one name, and the symbiont only have one name, and then when they're joined, the name is the both of them. That's how... Yes. They can, as Z asked Adira to speak her names, that's how they know, you know, what symbiont is they are talking to.
Yeah. No, I found that quite a revelation. Mm. But like I said, I've not seen DS9, so I wouldn't know what had happened previously.
Yeah. DS9 was a great source of information for trains, as we had one for 7 years.
Now, I don't know whether this is something that we need to be concerned about at all, but I did notice that Gray called Adira crazy twice and idiot once.
Well, teenage love. Yeah,
every day in this house.
It's not sophisticated.
It's not the basis for a loving relationship. You should hear the things Caroline calls me.
Right, so we are on to Act 4, the final act of this episode. Adira re-enters her memory as Gray opens her present. She explains that many cultures pass on stories via tapestries or kilts, with each piece representing a special moment or person. On the kilt she stitched for Gray, one panel depicts an instance in which they broke a replicator and it would not stop producing apples. That should be fun, you know. Only apples for dinner.
I like pie.
Yeah. Well, if the replicator doesn't replicate, you know, whatever is necessary to make the pie, you will only have apple.
Just go to a different replicator. Duh.
Duh. That means getting out of the room and doing stuff.
Turn those apples into applesauce. Go to the other replicator and say, give me a side of pork belly, please.
Ooh, nice.
Another tile shows a time they played imaginary chess. Gray says he loves it and calls Adira an art genius. I guess that was to balance the idiot and crazy words.
Yeah. Is it also an affirmation of the previous statement, have I always been a genius?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, Right.
Suddenly, an asteroid impacts the ship, severely damaging their quarters. Adira calls for medical drones to attend to Gray, who has been impaled. The drones determine Gray will not survive treatment, but that the Tal symbiont can be saved. Adira volunteers to become a host, knowing that the memories of Gray and all the prior hosts would be lost otherwise.
Right, so I got the sex thing wrong. I get that now.
Yeah. That's why I say that she was a winning host. She volunteered to get the host.
Having looked at more excellent work from the visual effects department of, you know, the body scans of the symbiont inside a human body, I was utterly perplexed how the symbiont had survived this impaling.
Unless the symbiont is not in the same position on in a human body than on in a train body.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm clutching at straws.
No, I don't know either. But something that Culber said at the beginning, so the beginning of this episode, the end of the last one, he made a comment about the symbiont being wrapped around the heart.
In this one at the beginning.
Yeah, and he almost sounded surprised about it. So maybe the symbionts grab anything.
Yeah, maybe. But it could only be surprised. As you said, there's no precedence. They don't know anything about Trail and symbiont. All their knowledge comes from the sphere, apparently.
Mm.
Exiting the memory into the now calmed neural space with Burnham, Adira is greeted by manifestations of the prior Tal hosts, including Senna and Gray. Senna notes that a human joining is unusual, but says Tal accepts Adira as a host. Burnham tells Senna that his message gave her hope. The manifestations disappear, and Adira and Burnham emerge from the milky waters in the cave pool. So yeah, that was all the previous incarnation, and I noticed there were 5 or 6 of them. I think Senna was not the only Starfleet host.
No.
I got that right.
There was somebody that appeared to have a Next Generation era uniform on as well.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
I think most of them, if not all of them, would have been Starfleet.
Except Gray.
Except Gray, yes.
Okay. Z asks Adira again to speak her names. She responds, I am Kasha Tal, Jovar Tal, Madela Tal, Kara Tal, Senna Tal, Gray Tal, and I am Adira Tal. The other Trill apologize for their prior treatment of her and say she will impact generations of Trill to come. Pav offers to mentor Adira, but she decides to stay with Discovery as it seeks out Federation headquarters. Pav hints that when the Federation returns, Trill would consider joining.
And that's huge.
Yeah.
Because even though Trill presumably has never been part of the Federation up to this point, there were still Trill in Starfleet.
Mm-hmm. Don't know if they were
Dax.
Part of the Federation. Dax was. Dax was a Starfleet officer.
And the former host was Starfleet.
Yeah. Kazan?
Yes, that's what I mentioned. Most of the people that were, most of the previous hosts from Tal were Starfleet officers.
Yeah, so I think Trill might... I'm not sure, but it's time for some Memory Alpha mojo. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the live search on Memory Alpha section of the episode. We need a jingle for that too.
For the benefit of the listener, Dave is now staring intently at his screen. We can't see his fingers moving, but if you listen very carefully, you can hear them.
Okay. While Trill was seen serving in Starfleet and as Federation diplomats, the Trill homeworld was never explicitly established as a member of the Federation.
There we go. So yeah, it's huge. Also, did you notice that when Pav said that they might join Starfleet, Burnham responded, it will be our honor, as in, you know, she's Starfleet. It seems that she's taking the role of representing Starfleet in this era.
Well, the Federation.
Yeah. She is in this case, right? She's the only one that's an actual officer, right?
Yeah, on the planet, yes. But I thought she was kind of, I wouldn't say stepping, you know, one step higher than what she could, but Yeah, I guess as the only representative of the Federation in the room.
Yeah, diplomacy training kicked in.
Yeah.
Pav did say they would consider joining. Yeah. So obviously it would be for the Federation, it would be in the Federation's honour to have them consider joining.
Yeah.
Not, it's not like she was saying, you're in.
Mm.
Okay, high five, you're in.
Although, you know, given the current state of affairs, I think they'll be, you know, giving out coupons to, you know, any all comers.
Yeah.
This is it. This is the great unknown, isn't it? We do not know what state the Federation's in. For all we know, Discovery is the remnants of the Federation.
Well, we've had hints as to where it is right now, which is it's a distant shadow of its former self.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I guess you're right, Martin. They will say, okay, you joined the Federation, now you
get, you know, a Federation. You have a referral program. Get a Federation. You get a Federation.
Get one world in and get one for right. Free. Thing like that. On Discovery, Saru mopes over the remaining of his ruined dinner party as Tilly returns to thank him. Saru laments that Captain Christopher Pike made connecting with the crew seem effortless. Tilly says that the crew decided together to travel into the future and are living together with the consequences of that decision, but that Saru's reminder of their connection shows leadership. Stamets enters and tells Tilly he has failed to appreciate her contributions and apologizes. He inquires about her spore drive research. She says she was examining dark matter and energy coefficient, but that she could not make the math work. Stamets says her idea would be revolutionary and that they should research it further.
I adored this scene. There was so much right with it.
Yeah.
Although it was very clear that the attempt that Saru made to reunite the whole crew, at first glance, that seemed to have backfired, but what it seemed to do is it forced everybody to realize that they were all suffering in different ways together.
Yeah.
So this kind of forced jollity of having a meal around a table, which then resulted in a quarter of the people effectively combusting, has actually proven to be a very effective form of therapy. Because now people realize there is a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, the next line of the next scene is kind of like the full stop of this entire process.
Mm-hmm.
That people now know there is a problem.
Yes.
So now they know that there is a solution.
Now they've reached the bottom and they can push on their feet and get back up.
But more importantly, they know they're at the bottom.
Yeah.
So this... what Saru did, although what he wanted to happen was something completely different, what ultimately happened was what he actually wanted.
And, we'll talk again later about that. I have something I want to mention. In sickbay, Detmer approaches Kelber and says she obviously is not okay, but that it was hard to admit. She accepts Kelber's offer to talk sometimes. Then the computer directs available crew to the shuttle bay for a surprise. There, the crew is watching a holographic projection of the 1924 Buster Keaton silent film Sherlock Jr. The crew laughs, and Linus hands her Hadoof Giorgio a box of popcorn. That was fun. She didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah, she was very reluctant. She didn't want to take it. She's like, go on then.
Detmer and Stamets silently apologize and embrace. In the rear of the crowd, Kelber notes to Saru that the crew had to admit they were not fine before they could begin to feel joy and heal. Saru reveals the movie was the idea of the sphere data that has begun to integrate into the ship's system. The crew worked to protect the data, now is trying to protect the crew, he speculates.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying to say earlier on.
Yeah.
Buster Keaton. I have so many issues with the whole Buster Keaton thing. Not least, why are the works of Buster Keaton in the memory banks of this computer? That feels like irrelevant information that should have been jettisoned centuries ago. And the incredulous canned laughter of the crew at slapstick that wasn't funny 90 years ago, let alone 400 years in the future.
Yes, but this is new to them, isn't it?
It was so weak. I mean, if they've got Buster Keaton, you know, they've clearly got the archives of Blockbuster there. I mean, Buster Keaton, it's no Police Academy 6, is it?
No.
Well, I don't know if the sixth one was funny, but the first one was.
Which one was 6?
I have no idea, but they got worse and worse and worse, and that's kind of my point.
Yeah. Yeah. They did, yes.
Yes. Yeah, so Saru says that the Sphere Data wants to protect them, but I'm not sure about that. I'm more with, I don't know which one of you said that earlier, that...
Buster Keaton is my evidence for this, you know,
yeah.
the brewing, the brewing malice, because...
You're not letting this go, really, are you?
This was the weak moment in this whole thing. It's up to no good. I think it did a very good job of persuading Saru to have them sit down for a meal and face their demons and realize that they're not well. The whole Buster Keaton thing, deeply suspicious.
Would Charlie Chaplin have been better?
No. Any silent film, deeply suspicious.
Yeah. So what I wanted to talk about earlier is that I think from the start, Culber was trying to have Saru do something like the dinner. I mean, he is the one who...
Set him down that
seed
path.
Of this. Yeah. Yeah. And then Saru asked the computer for something, and then the computer suggested the dinner. But I think deep down it's Culber's idea. And that's... I mean, I don't know if it's hard to say, because he's always smiling those days, you know, since he came back from the dead, he's always smiling. But I thought when he was talking to Saru, he was smiling like, okay, I put that out, and I did a great job here. So in my mind, he was the one who started that. Thank you. English is harder and harder, you know, when the end of the day arrives.
So here's your wild, unbelievable theory of the week. We need a jingle for that as well. Could Culber have been affected by the Sphere Data?
Oh, come on. Not the whole crew.
He's organic,
no,
though,
but
right?
As far as we know. Well, we believe he is. But he is not the Culber we knew in season one.
I just feel like he's on a higher plane now. I feel like he's human evolved. He's above the, you know, the petty annoyances of being 1,000 years displaced and all the rest of it.
Yeah, he seems like stable, like the only stable thing in this crew.
And Saru as well. You know, he doesn't seem to be buckling. He seems to be perplexed and challenged, but he doesn't feel like he's out of control or uncomfortable.
He's just been made captain. He's loving it.
I like Saru.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. I like Saru too. All right, let's finish this review with our last scene. In her quarters, Adira tells Burnham that Senna knew the necessary algorithm to find the Federation headquarters, handing Burnham a pad with the coordinates already entered.
Now, Burnham behaved like she knew what those coordinates represented.
But those coordinates... Like, what? What?
Are these the coordinates? So, I reckon she knows where that
is. It's not the busted up ship she was on in episode 2, is it?
Bookship?
No. She visited and brought in that guy that had spent 40 years manning that space station that was, you know, falling apart. And he greeted her as the Federation, although he wasn't, you know, an officer. His father and grandfather had been.
Sahir?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I don't know, but Probably not, but we'll know in the next episode. But yeah, she acted like she knew what those coordinates were. Adira pulls out a cello and plays a lullaby that she says was sung by Senatal's parents when he was a child. Her past host's memory are slowly returning. Burnham leaves, and a manifestation of Grey jokingly tells Adira that her bowing could use some work. He notes Adira did not tell Burnham that she can still see him. They both admit they do not know why or how she can still see him, and he helps her practice her bowing as Discovery flies away. I thought it was a bit rude, you know, she gave Burnham the pad and then she took her cello. I mean, if you're talking to someone, surely you're going to wait that the conversation is over and the person is gone before you're going to, you know, grab your musical instrument. I guess it was just there to remind us of that she was now joined and to echo the scene where Grey was playing the cello.
Yeah,
I thought it was misplaced. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it's not the only thing that was misplaced.
Oh-ho!
Being a musician, you kind of spot these things. And can I just point out, the word I'm about to use is not rude.
Okay.
When she was playing the cello, she was bowing the third string whilst fingering, not a funny word, the fourth string.
This is true.
She was misplaying the cello. So when Grey said she needs to work on her bowing, yeah, because she was playing the wrong string.
Well, you know, that's the magic of post-production.
Yeah, only in terms of what we were hearing.
Yeah.
Sure. Not in terms of... Just to give you another example, because this wound me up immensely. Here in the UK, we have a tradition that Christmas isn't Christmas until the Coca-Cola van starts rolling through our TV screens, okay? But also, the leader of the Christmas TV adverts at the moment is John Lewis. And they're the ones that tend to set the bar for the other retailers to try and do better. I think it was 2 years ago, the John Lewis advert featured Elton John. And it covered off his early life through to him being an adult. And I would imagine that was coinciding with the release of the film Rocket Man. Right at the very end of the advert, you see the adult, the current Elton John, he plays two notes on the piano. The notes we heard were not the notes he played. And that bugged me every time I saw it.
I'm not a musician, so I didn't even realize that. Yeah, well, that could have been one of your trivias.
I don't think I have any trivias. I think I've given them all. I think I gave them all as part of the review.
So, Martin, what did you think about this particular episode?
Well, I'm happy to answer that question, but I would like each of you to tell me, first of all, what you thought of this episode.
Okay, Dave?
I'm concerned. I thought, well, if you're going to measure its success by how often my eyes leaked, then this was an incredibly good episode. I can't find anything in this episode to complain about. I thought the tension of the crew, the way they dealt with the kind of explosion of emotions and the dealing and the release of stress over the dinner table was really good. The comedy in this season of Discovery is just so on point. It's brilliant. It's really subtle, but it is there. The symbiont connection thing, I'm not convinced about. I think they could have done a much better job with that, but I think they only could have done a better job had they split this over two episodes. And I think they had enough there to be able to split this over two episodes as part of an arc. But I think end to end, it's kind of taking us back to the self-contained storyline part of things, because clearly now the Adira origin storyline is done. It started last week, it's finished this week, it's done.
Yeah.
So where are we going to go from there? I don't know. I don't know how I feel about these Monster of the Week episodes, as I tend to refer to them, because in Picard, you just had a huge long 10-episode arc. which could have made one phenomenal film. But here we tend to be going back to the A-plot single episode storylines, which I don't know if I'm going to be enjoying these. If they keep doing it, I don't know whether I'm going to enjoy it or not. I really want to see where this is going to go. You know, this is episode 4 out of 13 episodes. And from all the questions that were asked in the first two episodes, which were key to the establishment of this particular season, we're not really getting any proper answers to them at the moment. And that's bugging me. It's concerning me. They're going to leave it to the last minute and then just rush the remainder. So I'll hold judgment. I'll wait to see what happens to the rest of it. But just from the purposes of this episode, I think it was really good. The acting, the storyline in and of itself was pretty spot on. So yeah, I've got no complaints.
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit less good than the previous ones. I liked the first three episodes a lot. This one had the surprises, stuff that I didn't expect, especially when Michael shot the three guards without, you know, really, not without any provocation, but, you know, point blank, she shot Voss, I think is his name. But I liked the non-Adira part of the episode. So all the stuff that happened on Discovery, the fact that Culbert was, you know, conducting this assessment of the crew, the dinner party, the explosion of the of that, and then the realization that they had that they all had the problem and now they could get better. So this part I liked, but everything that had to do with Adira, I was like, yeah, meh. And I really didn't like the cave part, because, you know, when I saw them on that, as I said, I thought, okay, we're gonna go into the mythical, the spiritual stuff, and I don't really like this kind of thing, but that's my opinion. So I'm kind of neutral about this episode. It's not a bad episode. It's not a good one either. Yeah, hopefully the rest of the season will be more like the first three episodes than this one.
Okay, interesting. So I think last time I was on, I probably explained I'm a science fiction fan first, and it just so happens that Star Trek intersects with that, and that's why I enjoy it and watch it. I'm not a Star Trek aficionado. I do enjoy, you know, watching these things. I have to say, the first episode of this season was great, and the second episode was even better, and the third episode was excellent, and I was really looking forward to coming on and speaking to you two about, you know, episode 4, and then we got this.
Yeah.
And what this left me feeling like is this was, I think, from my understanding of watching, you know, I've watched a lot of Star Trek, this felt like an episode of Star Trek, whereas the first three episodes felt like science fiction adventure. They were detached from Star Trek lore and all of that, and they really got to stretch their legs and have some fun, and I loved them. And this was littered with back references to Star Trek. You know, it was fan service. And like you, Yannick, the whole caves thing felt a bit wishy-washy and weak. Yeah. And the crew interaction stuff felt that, as you will know, I'm a huge fan of Voyager, best Star Trek ever. And the whole mentality of the crew and fatigue and what they're feeling is familiar with the grind of what the Voyager crew were feeling. But we didn't get into that territory with Voyager until like season 3. And we're into like the third episode of a season, and they're playing out a lot of that stuff, and it doesn't feel like they've had long enough to really sort of feel the gravitas of the situation. It feels a bit rushed, that their sort of emotional response to this is a bit accelerated. So I found this one, frankly, as a backdrop to the first three, a bit dreary, a bit slow. The cruise stuff is interesting, felt a bit premature, and the whole mystical caves thing didn't interest me a whole lot. And I'm hoping it'll be a return to form in episode 5.
Yeah, I hope so too.
And also Buster Keaton.
Not letting that one go,
are you? I really am not.
Yeah. No. Well, you know what? To make up for this very weak episode where you were a guest on this show, I guess we only have one solution, is that you have to come back before the end of the season and do another one. Hopefully it would be a better one.
I've only got between on a one Friday. Condition. Yeah, go on.
You have to renounce Voyager.
No.
We're never going to speak again.
You can't ask that from our guests.
Voyager's the quintessential Star Trek season series. You know, it's brilliant.
I'm almost done with rewatching the 7 seasons of Next Gen. I'm going to start Deep Space Nine, but when I'm done with Deep Space Nine, I'm going to rewatch Voyager.
Have you watched all of Voyager before?
I have watched, I think, 5 seasons.
5.
I think I didn't see the whole 6th and 7th season. I have seen once the final episode of the 7th season.
So,
but I don't really remember it.
I watched ad hoc episodes on actual steam-powered television, like, you know, in our old house of Voyager, enough that I bought the entire box set on DVD of everything, which I dumped into a media library. And shortly after the very first 256 megabyte Raspberry Pis were released, I made a front-end media player with the Raspberry Pi, and in the baby fog, you know, couple of years of my daughter being new to the world, you know, when I'd finished all of my chores for the day, I would sit in the front room and watch maybe 2 or 3 episodes of Voyager every night for 2 years between my daughter being 2 to 4 years old. And that was, so I look back at that time very fondly. It was, you know, Voyager was my little escape. I love it. Despite all of its terrible episodes, on the whole, I love it.
My entire opinion of Voyager is based pretty much on season 2, episode 15, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so actually, I did come back. I did come back and do that one episode with you.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, so, we're going to try and find a new date for you to be guest on this show. So, Dave. No trivia this week?
No, as I say, most of the trivia's kind of been covered off. Let me just quick have a nosy in and see if there's anything I've missed. Oh, the one thing I did want to point out is just a straightforward observation that season 3 of Discovery is so much more like Picard in terms of its production and the level of darkness and feeling in it than any of the previous Discovery seasons.
Do you think this is a realization that Star Trek appeals to a predominantly older audience and that maybe they've been pitching it too young for a few years now?
Well, we had this conversation a few weeks ago when we were trying to work out who Star Trek was aimed at. And when you looked at when Discovery came back, it was the first thing in the Star Trek, first TV series in the Star Trek universe since 2005. So you had this kind of opportunity to bring in a lot of new viewers. Mm-hmm. And I think what they did is they tried to make Discovery of the time, as in how things are done at the moment, the whole Hollywood violence and language and dark material and stuff like that.
And lens flares.
And badly prostheticized, whatever, Klingons. But when you look at how that is and then how season 2 of Discovery and then season 1 of Picard and then season 3 of Discovery, you've got this kind of natural progression from what they thought was the right thing to do to what obviously appears to be the right thing to do. But they were basing it around what they thought their audience was at the time. Mm. And they got it wrong.
Yeah, well, they didn't have any Star Trek on the air for
13 years.
13 years, yeah. So they didn't have a reference.
Apart from those ones we don't talk about.
I quite like the step change in energy between season 2 and season 3. I thoroughly enjoyed season 1 and season 2 of Discovery. I would say they're up there with, you know, the good Voyager episodes as some of the most enjoyable Star Trek that I've watched. But it was starting to feel like that whole, you know, conflict with the Klingons and that story was dragging out and was a little bit protracted. And they've done very well in actually nipping that up, closing that storyline down, taking the crew to a completely different place and reimagining the series in a, you know, in a, an entirely new way. And I applaud that because it would have been very easy to get sort of bogged down in sort of, you know, slogging out that whole, you know, Klingon war for longer and longer. And I'm glad that they just cut it off, took it in a new direction.
Yeah, I agree. When Discovery went in the future at the end of season 2, everybody was like, oh, it's not good. They're going somewhere we don't know. They're going to, you know, they screw everything up. But yeah, well, it's 900 years in the future, so they can, you know, change everything.
Right.
And it's good because now you, as a viewer, we are discovering this Star Trek world, which is not exactly the world we knew. So
right.
It's great. I like it. I like it a lot. I liked Picard and I like this season.
I saw some commentary online similar to what you're saying, you know, oh, well, you know, that's it. It's not going to be Star Trek anymore. It's going to be, you know, it's not going to adhere to, you know, the usual convention and familiarities and all the rest of it. And as I said earlier, as a science fiction fan first and a Star Trek enthusiast second, I'm all for that. You know, I heard some criticism of the first few episodes, like, oh, this is generic science fiction. It could be anything. It's just got the Star Trek name on it. And I'm like, yeah, and it's great. Yeah. This is like, yeah, you know, it's space adventure Trek. I love it. It was brilliant. Those first three episodes, absolutely loved. If the remaining, what are there, 9 episodes are like the first 3, then bring it on. Bring it on, yeah, for another 5 seasons. I love that.
Well, we know we're going to have a 4th season anyway, so they're starting
filming. Oh, we do? Okay.
Yeah, they started filming already.
How the hell? Well, that's going to be solitary then. How does this work?
Yeah. Well, maybe they're going to stop filming, but yeah, apparently they were...
Okay.
Well, started already.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
There are lots of ways this season could end. Oh, sorry, that was a really silly question. Of course, there are lots of ways this season could end. But some of the theories that have come up have been very wild and varied, including one that suggests they may actually be going back to the 22nd century again. 23rd century, whatever.
Yeah,
I really hope not. I mean, that sounds like massively drab.
It does. It's the shower scene, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah,
it's Bobby Ewing all over again.
Yeah, exactly. And then you woke up and it was all a dream,
yeah,
kind of thing. And yeah, that would be daft.
Yeah, and all of this pain and soul searching that we've just been talking about, you know, all gets wiped away. And that feels weak. I really hope they don't do that.
But one thing that can happen, because we don't know when they got the green light for the season 4. Is that maybe season 3 will end without answering all the questions and leave that to season 4. You know, if they had the green light for season 4 early in the production of this season 3, then maybe
they start moving into lost territory.
Yeah, which is why I was making the point earlier about the fact they cut off, you know, a story path and set off in a whole new direction. I was very encouraged by that because I know this is a bit of a generalization, but American serial dramas are not very good at knowing when it's time to stop, right? They go on for far too long.
Yeah.
And you see in other countries, they're very good at sort of, you know, identifying what was compelling and good storytelling, and when it's time to stop telling that story, finish it, close it down, and move on to creating a whole new, you know, story for your audience. So I kind of like the freshness of this episode, this season, and I hope that there are other seasons to follow that are equally fresh.
Yeah, I hope that too. Well, if none of you has anything to add to this review,
I have one thing, just one thing in true Columbo style. The only piece of trivia that I've got here that we haven't already covered off in some way, shape or form, and we all seem to have missed it, is that around the table, Culber referred to Giorgio as Emperor.
Hmm.
He referred to her as Emperor.
Isn't her alternate self an Emperor? Isn't that the title that she had?
Well, no, that is her. Mm. She is the alternate.
Yes, I realise.
And she is the mirror universe, yeah. Georgia. Well, obviously, because the prime universe one is dead. But I've certainly not picked up anything to indicate that her true identity, the fact that she was an emperor in the mirror universe, was ever made public knowledge.
Ah, you know, maybe they had a chat around a drink one night.
Hmm. It's possible.
Another example of him being very comfortable addressing the difficult topics.
Yeah. Maybe he's got some knowledge when he came back. Maybe he can, you know.
What, from the sphere data?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. That concludes our review of Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 4, Forget Me Not. Thanks to all of you for listening to our show. You can help us spread the love for this podcast by joining with a Trill symbiont to help transfer the knowledge down through the generations. Or if you think that the whole white eyes thing is a little bit too scary, you can simply share the address of our website on social media.
And you can find our website at tlgreyhot.org, where you'll see all the show notes for our previous episodes, our reviews, and of course you can leave a comment.
If you want to use a mean of communications that is outdated, you can send us an email at feedback@tlgreyhot.org.
We are on Twitter and Facebook. Our username on both of those services is TEGHpodcast. And we're also on Telegram at t.me/TEGHpodcast, which is the only place that you'll be able to see us make a complete hash of things live, as we will be publishing the link to our unlisted YouTube live stream there and there only.
Thanks to Memory Alpha, as always, we have based our review for this week's episode on their work, and this is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution non-commercial license.
And they did a really good job this week.
Yep.
The rest of this show is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution Share Alike license. See our website for details.
This podcast is part of the Other Side Podcast Network. Check out our website at otherside.network.
Next episode will be a review of Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 5, Die Trying. And we should be having a guest with us as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, talking about guests, Martin, where can people, find out about your multiple adventures on the internet?
Well, wimpiesworld.com is where you can find all of the places to connect with me. In this pandemic world, I've been experimenting with live streaming. So I've been doing stuff on YouTube and Twitch, and I've been doing geekery photo series on Instagram of projects that I'm working on. So I do live streams about the things that you've already seen on Instagram. So you get a sneak peek on Instagram. Mm. And there's also a link to the Wimpy's World Discord server there, where we've got nearly 1,000 people of, you know, Linux and free software nerds hanging out in there. Also where the Ubuntu Mate team now reside. So it's becoming a sort of a melting pot for a number of projects and interests and what have you. So wimpiesworld.com, and you can find all of the links at the top of that site where you can choose how you want to follow me either, you know, on Twitter or, you know, video stuff.
Okay, cool. And as Excellent. We said, we're going to have you back on the show later on, hopefully with a better episode than this one to review.
Yeah, try and choose a good one next time, please.
Well, that's the only caveat. We can't really tell in advance.
No, we can't. Especially if we book a date a few weeks earlier, just, you know, for
organization.
I'm guessing like third episode from the end, penultimate episode, that's probably they'll probably be good ones.
Okay.
We're going to see.
The only problem is we don't know when they're going to be yet.
Right.
No, okay. But around January, something like that.
Well, yeah. just get your people to call my people.
Okay. Dave, don't we have a guest scheduled for the end of the show that is also guest with Martin on another podcast?
We do. And I think that I've got a date for that. We don't know which episode that's going to be because at some point, Yannick and I are going to take a week off for Christmas. So I think it's the second.
What's Christmas this year?
It's a thing I've heard about. We do have a date where one of your Ubuntu podcast co-hosts will be joining us, and it's not the angry one.
That's a spoiler.
Yes. Right, so that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you, Dave, for joining me once again and reviewing this episode.
Love it.
We will be back next week with a whole lot more of Star Trek. In the meantime, keep your distances, stay home, take care of yourselves. Ciao, ciao.
See ya.
Stay safe.
And a title, please, Yannick.
Yes. What is it? Oh, yeah.
See what I did?
Gilbert suggests that they travel to Trill to seek the... Dave is gone.
Just shutting out the Great British Bake Off, that's all.
Adira also jocularly... Adira also jocularly hears.
Do it in French.
On the kill, she's teach.
Save that for later. We're on Twitter. And he said Fitter and Facebook again.
You've been listening to a member of the Otherside Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.